You don't have a choice. That disappeared a long time ago. There's not a nickel's worth of difference between the Democratic and Republican Party, and hasn't been for an awful long time. And it doesn't matter which one is in the White House, we still go toward the New World Order, don't we? But if they were truly different, that wouldn't happen, would it?
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. How likely is the Israeli government able to kill Palestinians, safe in the knowledge the British press and the left won't dare speak out against them? Yes, the worrying is Israel's secret program to skew debate on Wikipedia and reporting online as it uses its armed forces against civilians on the ground. Also, as technology races forwards, and the last people to notice seems to be our MPs and congressmen and women, there is no UK or international law really governing lethal autonomous weapons, that's killer robots to you and me, with chilling adverts showing how easy it is for a drone to kill anyone to order. Where is the law? What's the UN doing? And why are Google employees and academics in the US putting pressure on Google to disengage from its private military contracts, which could see your online browsing behaviour used to add you to the latest drone kill list? But first, another good cause bites the dust. Campaign for Press and Broadcasting Freedom, along with its periodical Free Press, copies of which are available in our studio here, will be closing down on or by the end of November this year. We're joined tonight by Mike Jempson. He's arguably the Bristol contingent, a man who's been there almost from the start of the campaign, set up a journalism rights charity himself, media-wise, here in Bristol. So why is the Campaign for Press and Broadcasting Freedom folding, just as UK press freedom and diversity is arguably at its lowest ebb? Our sister show Dialect's back on BCFM, 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. Catch it online now if you want at dialectradio.co.uk. This week, Glastonbury Abbey is open for business, with a whole lot being found out all the time about the early Christian settlements on the site and also the reasons why Henry VIII wanted to make it the ruin it is today. Part one of a two-part round tour of the Abbey and its history. That's Dialect on BCFM at noon next Tuesday, or download it from dialectradio.co.uk now. But first, I'm joined by Mike Jempson from the Campaign for Press and Broadcasting Freedom. Mike, you also set up a charity here in the city. Can you tell us about some of the early days of this campaign? I think it's 40 years old, isn't it?
It'll be 40 years old next year. It was started in 1978 during the Winter of Discontent, as it was lovingly called by the Daily Mirror, at a time when the unions and progressive activists were getting a pretty hard time from the mainstream press, not to mention the Labour Party. And there was a lot of anxiety amongst print workers and journalists about what was happening. And so the campaign, which was originally called the Campaign for Press Freedom, was set up by a group of journalists and academics and trade union activists. And by the way, it's not sort of closing down. That's certainly not by choice. I mean, the big reason for that is lack of funding. So much has changed, which we perhaps can go into. But although we just do not have the money to carry on, to sustain an office and staff, the campaigning will continue, but in other forms.
But the Winter of Discontent, I mean, certainly the way most people look back on it now is that this was really the unions overstretching themselves, causing so much trouble that they ended up being hated more than the government was back at the end of the 70s.
Well, it depends who you're talking to, I think. I mean, you'll find that one of the big problems was their causes were being so poorly represented. And, of course, at the time, unions were not very good at handling the media themselves, so it was always an afterthought. And things did get out of hand, it's true, and it was a difficult period. In fact, I was a young journalist at the time, and we were on strike throughout the winter of 1978 because our employers, we then had a national wage agreement, as did many unions, and our employers, the Newspaper Publishers Association, were not willing to negotiate. So we weren't the only ones. There were public sector workers on strike as well. Things did get very unpleasant. And of course, it's always the unions that get the blame.
The union was on strike for how long were you on strike for then?
The NUJ members were on strike, I think, for 7 weeks, if I remember rightly.
So that means no news, does it? In various outlets.
This was a national strike of provincial newspapers. So it was the local press that was on strike. Some of the publications still came out rather thinly, run by their managements, and some scab labour. But for the most part, they weren't being published. We, for instance, in East London, were publishing our own little newsletter. And subsequently, we set up a thing called East End News as a cooperative venture to provide an alternative view of what was happening in East London at the time.
Now, the 1970s were a very different time because it was really the 80s that the technology changed, and we started getting digital printing, that sort of thing, with particularly with Rupert Murdoch sort of leading the way. What was the relationship like between the journalist unions and the print unions back in the 70s?
Well, of course, it was Eddie Shah who was used to launch a newspaper today using the new technology. And, of course, one of the big problems was that journalists were used. There was a whole process which involved a variety of different print unions in producing newspapers at the time, and a lot of employers, for instance, were not very keen on bringing computers into the newsroom. I started out on a typewriter, and it took a very long time for computers to come into the newsroom. And then you had the problem that you were able to produce copy which didn't need to be reset by the printers. And what happened was the initial antipathy between the two groups of workers was resolved by a lot of very difficult negotiation, which included the idea of merger. And quite a few print workers actually, including some who were very active in the campaign, became journalists too.
So the difference in the technique, what was it between the hot metal days and the somehow a journalist types something and then it automatically gets put onto...
Gradually you reach the point where, as now, I mean, I was, for instance, producing community newspapers, and indeed the Campaign for Press Freedom's newsletter for 3 years, cutting and pasting typed material on my kitchen table. And then that would go off to be photographed and then made into plates. So it was a very, very different style of working to what you have now with sort of systems within newspapers, which are like a sort of formulaic way of producing a page, what it looks like, how many words you're going to get on that page. Whereas when I started out, you had to know the width of each letter, especially when making up headlines. And it was, you know, the skill set you needed was very, very different.
When the Campaign for Press and Broadcast Freedom first started, what was your... Do you have any specific aims? Do you have anything particularly in mind to try and achieve?
There were a series of very important issues which remain just as apposite now. One of them was about plurality, the need for a variety of different types of publication and different systems of ownership, as well as different owners, because even then there was a very limited range of owners of a very limited range of, if you like, political views in the mainstream press, most of whom were opposed to the Labour Party and the Labour movement in particular. So that was one thing, the whole issue of ownership and control. And another was the right of reply, because in those days you had, particularly when you're talking about industrial disputes or progressive movements like CND, for instance, and peace movements, you'd get very, very negative coverage, and there was no guarantee that people would be asked for their point of view. The same was true, too, about reporting on ethnic minorities. So newspapers are quite happy to produce what we would now consider to be racist copy and never think about asking black people or gypsies, for instance, what their point of view was. So one of the big issues for the campaign was to get a statutory right of reply. And I think it's worth pointing out that, for instance, in France and Belgium, there's been a right of reply if a newspaper gets things wrong since the 19th century. And most European countries have got a right of reply so that if a newspaper gets things wrong, they're expected to allow the person who they've misrepresented to give their point of view soon afterwards. And the campaign has written and developed a whole series, I think five different bills to try and get a statutory right of reply in this country.
But no success?
No, they've had all party support, but they've been attacked, of course, by the mainstream press throughout, and none have got beyond a second reading. I was particularly involved with the first one was with Frank Alorn in about 1983-84, and then you had Tony Worthington, you had Anne Cluett, later you had Peter Bradley and Austin Mitchell. But the bill I got most involved with was Clive Soley's Press Freedom and Responsibility Bill. And we organised in Parliament special hearings where members of the public who'd been trounced by the press and the regulator then, the Press Complaints Commission, and the print unions were invited to come and talk through some of the issues. It was a very unusual proceeding. The bill, however, fell at the second reading, as it usually does in these cases. And we then gathered 70 different people and organisations who'd had a hard time from the press in Parliament, and they were invited, or the press were invited, to meet them. Not a single journalist turned up. So the people present then got very angry, and they came up with ideas for an organisation to take the place of the body that Clive Soley had been proposing, and that's how PressWise, now MediaWise, got started.
Very frustrating, isn't it? It seems that the press have got something they want to tell people. They don't always want to listen.
Well, I mean, these are difficult things, especially nowadays when everybody sort of shouts and hollers about fake news. Most of the stuff in newspapers is not fake news. There is stuff, which I've been exposing through MediaWise for many years now, which is not complete or which is deliberately misdirecting people. But it's interesting that for all the fact that I've spent much of my career criticising the media, my colleagues in the NUJ have recognised how valuable this sort of work is. And I've been awarded a gold medal by the union, and in fact a life membership now, for the work that I've done on trying to promote journalistic ethics, because most journalists want to be able to tell the truth and not to be subjected to the sorts of pressure that often happens in national newspaper newsrooms.
I mean, we're talking about the old hot metal days, and also, of course, the ownership here of the Bristol Post used to be locally owned. In fact, it was set up originally to be a locally owned newspaper, wasn't it?
Well, most were. But in fact, in the 1920s, when there were all sorts of problems, as you know, in terms of the economy, what you got was a sort of gentleman's agreement between the various different, mostly family firms that ran local papers. And I think there were two or three in Bristol then. They sort of agreed that everybody would have a town each. And that's how we got the Evening Post as it is now. Now, the ironical thing is that when at the time the campaign started, the Evening Post was one of the best local papers to work for. It had very good reputation, it had excellent wages, had a lot of staff. It was the sort of paper people wanted to be on. Sadly, that's no longer the case.
What's changed?
Well, ownership other for than a start. Ownership. I mean, ownership has changed hands several times.
It's gone over to the Daily Mail, first of all, and then now to
and now
Trinity
to the Mirror Group, Trinity. Well, that's changed its name too now. And it had at one
interestingly,
time
interestingly with the same editor
from
Northcliffe, which is the Daily Mail, to the Mirror, you would expect that there'd be a change of editor. No,
newspaper owners employ the editors they think will do their whim, and once upon a time the Evening Post, for instance, had a former Guardian associate editor as its editor and was a very feature-full newspaper, so lots of in-depth stuff and longer pieces of journalism. They then hired a tabloid editor who completely transformed the paper, and in doing so, very interestingly, expanded the readership, so that it became a much more popular paper, and that's a good thing. But it also became very formulaic, and it lost, they got rid of all the feature writers. And now you get very little coverage of the local authority, for instance. There isn't enough staff to do things in depth. And so the Evening Post now has had to rely on what are called the democracy reporters, paid for by the BBC out of our licence fee payers' money.
Well, it's interesting, we still call it the Evening Post, don't we? That's actually the Bristol Post. It stopped being an evening paper quite a while ago, but that...
Well, yes, once it was had three issues a day and several on Saturday, and the Pinkun and the Greenun, etc. Yeah, it's a very changed beast.
Somebody that worked in the early days of the Post, when it was still hot metal, that is to say, a different style of print room where individual compositors would make up the printing blocks from little bits of metal, that is to say, with letters on them, they would make up the stories. One of the people that used to work there was a chap called Dennis Pater, and I spoke to him a few years ago as part of something called the National Union of Journalists Oral History Project, and here he is just giving us a flavour of what life was like back before they went over to the digital press.
For a whole generation now, they have only known the Evening Post and Western Daily Press to be up at Temple Way. Whereabouts was it in Broadmead?
Opposite the Odeon, down the bottom of the hill there. And in fact, the building as such is still there, opposite the fire station, next to the Bridewell police station. The building is still there with shops on the ground floor level and offices above. So they've utilised the building. Well, and
now, most of us know what a modern newsroom looks like. Give us you've already told us a little bit, but give us a sort of sweep round the newsroom in those days. Maybe talking about the 1960s, I guess.
Well, certainly from the journalist's point of view, they all seem to be huddled together in very small rooms with banks of paper on spikes everywhere and cluttered desks of newspapers and paper and typewriters clattering away, and all the guys seem to be smoking in those days, and ties undone round their waists. Some guys would wear the visor shade, like you see in some of these films, but there was a great atmosphere. And in the composing room, again, it was very noisy with the hot metal. And on edition time, a journalist, a sub, would come down to the composing room to sub the page, a great big hot metal page, and he'd stand on what was called the stone, the other side of the stone from the compositor. And he would instruct the compositor what changes he'd made. He'd have his galley proofs, as they were called, that were pulled and inked up the type and pulled, so that the journalist had his galley proof to make his late corrections. Sometimes there wasn't time for all the corrections to go. They had to go without them. But in the old days, there was the barrier where the NGA wouldn't let anybody else touch the type. And that applied to the journalists as well. And one former editor of the Evening Post, who will remain nameless, showed me a permanent dent he had on the back of his hand, where one day he went to touch the type and he was warned not to. And a few minutes later, he did touch the type and he was hit on the back of the hand with a wooden mallet. So, you know, the demarcation was very strict in those days.
As someone who's been working here as well recently, you talked about the atmosphere in the old paper. How has the atmosphere changed over the years?
Well, it's very much seems library-like to me now. It's very quiet, unless a really big news story breaks.
Very quiet. But what interests me, Mike, is this whole idea of the editor not actually getting involved, that really the journalist and the compositor there are the only two people who are involved in writing that story. Nowadays, the journalist will press the button and anything could happen to that story. It can be edited, it can be subbed and changed before it actually reaches the newspaper.
No, I think you've got that quite right. In fact, at the time that being talked about there, you'd also have a reader. So once the stuff had been typed up and set and the galley proof had been produced, which was like a sort of rough print, you'd have a reader who was not a journalist, who was one of the print unions, who would sort of check it for obvious spelling errors, etc., and might draw attention to those, and then you'd have a sub who'd go down and point out that this and that had to be changed. But I mean, the editor had overall charge and would normally have passed, either him or one of his deputies, and they were mostly men, would have passed the proofs down to be published. I think one of the sad things about here in Bristol is that the old print room, or the new print room if you like, down at the post buildings has now gone.
That's sort of Temple Way.
It's now office blocks, and it shows, you know, what the real interests of these huge corporations that own the media are really interested in. I mean, they're vast corporations who have lots of other interests, some of which one could say, and this was one of the main points of the campaign, was that, you know, that might actually interfere with the nature of the coverage that they might give. So, for instance, if I own a newspaper and I also own forests, oil producing transport systems, maybe even hotel systems. So I might have interest in a whole range of things which are linked to the print industry, but which in fact have got their own economic lifestyle, and I may not want people interfering with that. So how do the financial journalists, for instance, on a newspaper deal with other companies that are linked to their to the company that they're working for? Raises some very interesting problems. So in terms of transparency and accountability, these were the sorts of things that the campaign wanted to draw attention to. And we did a huge amount of work in helping people to understand the links between these industries and who really owns the newspapers, and not just the newspapers. Here in Bristol, for instance, at one time, you had the Daily Mail behind the local paper. They were also behind the sort of electronic news systems that you got on your television in those days. What was that called?
CFAX,
etc. They also had shares in the local TV company. So without realising it, people were actually, and the Western Daily Press, of course, and the Free Weekly Observer. So people weren't aware that much of the stuff they were getting was originated from one source, and that source was not local journalists. It was a news company based in London, with owned by people who lived abroad and had their money fixed abroad, and they weren't even paying British tax. And that makes a big difference when you think about what it is you're supposed to be reading in the papers and who sets the news agenda.
Well, I mean, it's like something like Brexit, for example. I wonder whether some of the newspaper owners had a mind to what was going to happen with their tax havens depending on what the result of the Brexit vote was.
Well, far be it from me to say that that would influence what they might have to say about Brexit, but it's pretty clear that the level of hypocrisy amongst those people who own our newspapers is hard to quantify.
Has it been concentrating over the 40 years the CPBF's been around into fewer hands, or is it diversified?
Because we've got the internet. Not at all. There is diversification in the sense that there are many more local initiatives, for instance, and you have to watch out, because if you get a successful local initiative, do you remember here in Bristol we had Our School magazine, for instance, which was a really interesting idea developed by some parents and they sort of created a magazine which would be centred on children's school leads. That was so successful that it got bought up by the Evening Post, and that before it disappeared altogether. So it's successful.
Bought up
local,
and shut down.
Eventually, partly because a result of a rather bizarre scandal. But the I mean, that's one of the difficulties. If you are able to produce a medium which is successful and is attracting advertising, like the first community radio station here in Bristol, it'll get bought out and changed because it's discovered a niche from which money could be made. And that's the key issue about most media companies. They're about making money, not about the journalism.
What about some of the recent cases? We had journalist Mark Watts on here a few weeks ago talking about the Cliff Richard verdict. The BBC, I'm not sure if they've decided whether they want to appeal yet, but this is really effectively saying that even if it's quite true what a newspaper, or in this case the BBC, is saying, in this case about Cliff Richard's house being raided, that they're not allowed to report it. I mean, I wonder what were you making of that?
That's not quite what the ruling said or was about. And in fact, very little has been said about the nurse who was identified as the person considered to be at the centre of the deaths at a hospital. If you remember, there were a series of deaths, children's deaths at a hospital, and several of the newspapers not only named but published pictures of the nurse who was supposed to be involved in this. We don't know, she's never been charged, but as with the Cliff Richard thing, so far as I was concerned, and I've written about this, the big issue there was whether or not the BBC should have hired a helicopter and flown over the property and filmed the police in the property. That was highly sensational. It was unnecessary. It would have been perfectly proper for them to report that the police were going to investigate or to search his house, even though no charges had been laid. And if they'd left it there, I don't think they'd have had half the problems that they've got now. It was the intrusive way that they tried to cut out any opposition, any competition, and show that they had sort of snapped this exclusive that was the real problem.
I mean, isn't there a bit of a problem developing, Mike, that that when you're wealthy, it's actually easier to take the press to court? I mean, this is true over libel and things like that. Wealthy people are a threat to editors. They bite their nails. They say, "Oh, should we run this story or not?" If someone's wealthy, whereas if someone's poor, they're, you know, forgive the phrase, easy meat for the tabloids.
Yeah, I think it's slightly more complicated than that. It is a fact, though, for instance, that if you live on a council estate, for instance, or in a terrace, your privacy is much less easy to protect than if you live in a gated community or behind high walls, or indeed if you've got a great deal of money. The libel laws have actually been liberalised in some ways, although the idea of ordinary people being able to use the sort of no win, no fee has changed a bit, but it's always been the case that those people who are wealthy can stop stories appearing. And indeed, I think one of the things that I would like to know more about, and if we're talking about transparency, is how many cases have there been where newspapers have not run stories because they've been contacted by wealthy solicitors or solicitors of wealthy people and persuaded not to run a story. It's much more difficult to do that if you're an ordinary person with no public standing, if you like. And they're the sort of people that I've been dealing with at MediaWise for the last 25 years. And they get a rough deal and very often have very little chance of getting redress.
With all your experience of doing this, Mike, are there one or two changes that you'd still like to see? Just simple changes that would actually make a big difference?
Well, very complicated, really. I mean, I think first of all, it would be a very good idea if there were more transparency about who owns the press. I think that organisations such as the so-called Independent Press Standards Organisation were open, much more open about not only the way it handles complaints, but also having working journalists involved. At the moment, it's sort of it's a club which does have public sector or members of the public represented there, but it's still very much an editor's club. And it doesn't really provide the opportunity that so many people want to actually talk to people about the issues that have been raised by bad coverage. So you don't have the opportunity for sort of oral hearings, which you used to have once upon a time with the Broadcasting Standards Council, for instance. And that made a huge difference. So that sort of thing, I think, would make a big difference. I think the right of reply shouldn't be a fear for the press. I mean, they have misrepresented Leveson and Leveson's recommendations. They misrepresented the right of reply, and it shouldn't be a problem, because if you don't get things wrong, if you don't deliberately misrepresent what people say, you wouldn't have to offer people a right of reply. So it's a question of getting things right, or as close to right as possible first time, and then admitting it when you've got things wrong. And at MediaWise, we have a very simple credo. We say that press freedom is a responsibility exercised by journalists on behalf of the public. It doesn't belong to the owners or to the editors. It belongs to the public. And the public have a right to be told when the media get things wrong. And that way we would be able to kill off all this nonsense about fake news. And if our journalists were, how should we put it, freer to be able to challenge some of the nonsense that both politicians and people like Trump bellow at us, maybe people would have a bit more confidence in the media. And that's the saddest thing, is that people have lost confidence in good journalism.
Well, it's in a way a pity you said that today, Mike, because Trump has just been proved right, hasn't he, today? Because there were stories about him arriving 15 minutes late to see the Queen. Everyone, including the BBC, has had a good look into that, and they found that actually the Queen was 15 minutes early. So it was
no
fake news.
Idea or interest in the behaviour of monarchs or Trump when he's visiting them, I'm afraid. I think there are much more serious things to concern ourselves with.
I mean, the fake news is, I mean, this was really started year before last at a press conference by, as I remember, Merkel and Obama talking about fake news in the presidential election campaign, in the US presidential election campaign. And that was actually at the same time that Google were doing something. Do you think there's anything real being done about, I mean, what we're talking about effectively is lies, and it's not just coming out of the internet, it's also coming out of the press as well, with things like weapons of mass destruction before the Iraq war.
Well, it wasn't the press who talked about weapons of mass destruction. That came from politicians, don't forget. And it may well be, I think it is right to say that the press didn't do enough to challenge that. And it is our job as journalists to challenge and to check, especially what politicians say, and especially when people's lives are at risk. But I mean, fake news has been around for a very long time. Indeed, the first code of conduct produced for journalists in this country was back in 1884, and it was done by the Gentlemen of the Press, who disliked the yellow press of the day and wanted to show that they were a cut above all these people who are writing sensational stories based on court cases, so sex and violence stories in the, or what we'd call the tabloid, but there were sort of penny dreadfuls. And so they set up an organisation which still exists today, the Institute of Journalists, and developed a sort of code of conduct, which eventually would be changed into the NUJ's code at a later stage. But journalists themselves are the ones who are saying, we've got to make sure that we have some integrity and some ethics about what we do. Unfortunately, a commercial press, with all the pressures that are involved, especially with 24-hour rolling news, what happens is everybody wants to get in on the act, and it's not who's right, it's who's first that seems to be more important.
Okay, it's crystal ball time, Mike. What with Leveson being only very semi-effective after this horrendous phone? I mean, it was awful, the phone hacking scandal where you've got people's answer phones being hacked into. The idea was, oh, we're going to have to get a better press as a result of it. Very little really seems to have changed. What's your view of the future?
Well, I mean, I think for a start, one of the things that's really encouraging is how many local initiatives, like here in Bristol, have been developed, partly because the mainstream has been shedding journalists like nobody's business. So we have things like Bristol Cable and Bristol 24/7 and the Voice Network here, all of which are initiatives from journalists who had been working at the Post. That's a very encouraging development. And I'm a little nervous about encouraging the internet as the only way forward, but it's certainly very interesting to see how direct contact seems to make a difference. But you need a lot more media literacy for people to be able to understand what's happening if they're only getting their news from Instagram or Twitter or Facebook or whatever. So I think that the other thing that's interesting is I've been working in Europe with other groups of people in about 14 different countries, and there are similar concerns there and similar interests in new types of media initiative, which could hopefully make a big difference.
Well, what they're saying, Facebook, people like that, is that, oh, well, in social media now we're taking fake news very seriously. We will have fake news monitors.
Yeah, I believe they've got several hundred thousand people allegedly checking things, but who these people are and what experience they've got. It's a bit like the fact that local newspapers have, or most many newspapers, have done away with subs. And subs were usually the old hacks whose legs had gone, but who knew a thing or two and could look at a story and see whether it really stood up. And they knew the local area and the local streets and some of the local people, so they could really had a sort of wise eye over what was being published. Now we find that sub-editing, if it's done at all, is done a long way from where the newspapers are being produced or where the readers are. So all sorts of errors creep in. And I think that, you know, we need to see a lot more investment in proper journalism. Journalism is a career that lots of people want to go in for. I've been teaching it for the last 10 years at UWE, and there's no shortage of students, but there is a shortage of jobs. There are plenty of people who can do the jobs if only the newspapers would actually invest in journalism.
I mean, since the demise, many would say, of the unions, since, you know, the 1970s, slowly but surely, more and more difficult to keep your job. Do you think that makes a difference when it comes to what journalists write about, whether they can write what they in conscience want to, or whether they're constantly thinking, crikey, if I say this, I might lose my job?
Well, I mean, partly it's to do with employment contracts. I mean, a lot of journalists are on short-term contracts, especially in media, and that does inhibit their willingness to take risks, for instance, or to cover problematic stories. Certainly the unions have changed dramatically, so all the print unions are now sort of folded into one big union which incorporates all sorts of other interests too, and that's one of the reasons why the campaign has begun to lose money, because you've got not lots of different members but one big member, and that limits the amount of funds that might be available. Excuse me. But the positive thing is that there's a whole new generation. I mean, I'm an old hack. There's a whole new generation of young people, the sort of people who'll be at the Byline Festival in a couple of weeks' time, who are seeing the world very differently, who are much more into direct action themselves, who are much more interested in working on both single issues, but also seeing the links between different issues. And, you know, at the campaign's last AGM, we were talking about the fact that this is, you know, probably the way forward, and the campaigning will now be done through those sorts of organisations like Byline, And also through the fact that the academy has taken a more of an interest in the what's called the sort of political economy of the media, and so are able to do the research and produce information which will help people to understand more what's going on.
So it's not that the campaigning's gone, it's just the campaign.
Yes, the particular campaign, it's a bit like media-wise, it's very, very difficult to get funding. When you've got a lot of publicity around something like the Hacked Off campaign, I mean, that began to sort of drain any financial support that we were able to get. I still provide a service for people who are having difficulties with the media, but there's no funding in ethics, and we've also found that there's also no funding in, if you like, political campaigning. It's very interesting, though. There have been 5 right of reply bills, okay? They didn't come to anything, but it kept the issue alive. And if you look at some of the parliamentary debates, some of the things that were being said 20, 30 years ago are still true now. The only people who don't seem to get the message are the media owners. The Campaign for Freedom of Information, which sort of spun off from the CPBF, has been very effective in getting us freedom of information legislation. Article 19, promoting freedom of expression, also sort of took on some of the things that the campaign was working on, and has been very effective, not just in this country, but internationally. So, you know, there are lots of very positive things that have come out of the work that we've done over the last 40 years.
The one anomaly in all of this is the BBC. Do you think they'll survive?
Well, it's an interesting beast, and I think I was very interested many years ago, although I never belonged to a political party. I was part of a group that helped to produce a policy for the Labour Party on the BBC Charter. It was a very interesting document, which I did the final edit on. And sometime later, I happened to be involved in discussions at the BBC about something else. And somebody, one of the senior executives, started talking to me about some ideas which I thought I recognised. And at the time, I think we were coming up to an election. I can't remember whether it was the 92 election, where there was a possibility of a Labour government. And all of a sudden, these executives were talking around the very issues that was in this document. So they'd got hold of it, and they were seeing where was the, you know, how the writing was on the wall, and so they ought to be in line with what the thinking of a potential new government. Of course, that went out the window as soon as Labour didn't win that particular election. And I think that one of the things we've got at the moment is an anxiety within the BBC about how they do survive, and that means sort of playing along with the prevalent establishment view of what they should be doing.
Well, that's easy for them to do, really, with the various chairmen that they've had over the last few years from the City of London. David Clementi is the latest chairman of the BBC, former from Climeworth Benson, who were well known as the big privatisers. Mm. So it does seem to be that the establishment has got financial whiz kids running the corporation these days.
Well, unfortunately, that's been the case since the Peacock reports back in the 1980s, and although Mr. Burt, who was the Director General at one time, had some quite good ideas about the mission to explain, he also helped to bring in this idea of the internal market, which really destroyed the notion of creativity and risk-taking inside the BBC.
Well, I'll have to agree with you, because I was there at the time. Nobody liked it, and it completely... Well, basically, we worked around it.
Mm. Well, not anymore. No. And whilst I think it's been quite good that independent production has become more of a feature of BBC programming, I think that's, you know, it's now become much more a part of it. I think it was once 25%. I think it's a much higher percentage now. I think all the controversy about the cost of talent has not done the BBC much good. But it also means that, you know, they really are in a competitive market, and that, you know, the amount of money they can pay becomes the important thing rather than the notion of some sort of public service, which is what it's supposed to be.
I hope you're listening, BBC. Anyway, thanks very much, Mike Jempson, for taking us through some of the trials and tribulations of 40 years of the campaign for press and broadcasting freedom. And I guess that the easiest way to find out what Mike's been up to is go through the MediaWise website, and that is still... Or follow Mike on Twitter. And if you have been maligned by the press, Mike's your man.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Now we're going to take a look at lethal autonomous weapons, and here is a little extract from a film about it, which is just out, in fact, a podcast. We start by looking at where the law is on these killer robots at the moment, and the chat we're going to hear from now is Peter Asaro from New York City University.
A lot of the work I've been doing under a grant for the Future of Life Institute looks at liability in increasingly autonomous systems. And within a civilian domestic application, of course, the big application that everybody's looking at the moment is the self-driving car. So you can ask this question, who's responsible when the self-driving car creates an accident? And the way that liability law works, of course, somebody somewhere is always going to wind up being responsible. The law will find a way to hold somebody responsible. The question is whether existing precedents and the ways of doing things under current legal frameworks is really just, or is really the best way going forward as we have these kinds of increasingly autonomous systems. So in terms of holding persons responsible and liable, so under tort law, if you have an accident, then you can sue somebody. So this is criminal law, this is the law of torts. And under that, then you sort of receive monetary compensation for damages done. But ideally, the person or agents or company or what have you that causes the harm is the one that should pay. Of course, that's not always true. And the way that liability works does things like joint and several liability, in which even though one party only had a small hand in causing a harm, they may have lots of money, like a government or a state or a city or something like that. And so they may actually wind up paying far more as a share of damages than they actually contributed to a problem. You also have situations of strict liability, such that even if your agency in causing a problem was very limited, you can still be held fully responsible for the implications. There's some interesting parallels here with the keeping of animals, which are kind of autonomous systems, in a sense. They have their minds of their own. They sort of do things. On the other hand, we expect them to be well-behaved and well-trained, at least for domestic animals. So generally speaking, you have liability for harms caused by your dog or your horse and so forth as a domesticated animal, but you don't have strict liability. So you actually have to show that maybe you've trained your dog to attack, or you've failed to, you know, properly train your horse or keep it in a stable or what have you. Whereas if you keep a tiger or something like that and it gets out and causes harm, then you're strictly liable. So the question is, for a robot, should you be strictly liable for the robots that you create or the robots that you own? Should corporations that manufacture these systems be strictly liable for all of the accidents of self-driving cars? And while that seems like a good policy from the perspective of the public, because all the harms that are caused by these systems will be compensated, that can also stifle innovation. In the car sector, that doesn't seem to be a problem. As it turns out, the president of Volvo said that they will accept strict liability for all of their self-driving cars. Tesla Motors has, you know, released a number of autopilot systems for their cars and more or less accepted the liability for that, although there's only been a few accidents. So the actual jurisprudence or case law is still really emerging around that. But those are, I think, a technology where the cars are very expensive. There's a lot of money to be made in self-driving cars. And so the expectation of the car companies is that there will be very few accidents and that they can really afford to pay the damages for all those accidents. Now, is that going to be true for personal robots? So if you have a personal assistant, sort of butler robot who maybe goes on shopping errands and things like that for you, there's a potential for them to cause significant economic damage. They're probably not going to be nearly as expensive as cars, hopefully. And it's not clear that the market for them is going to be as big, and it's not clear that companies would be able to absorb the cost of strict liability. So there's a question of whether that's really the best policy for those kinds of systems.
Yeah, so that's Peter Osoro from New York City University. Also, we have Martin, I'll just bring you in on this, because the United Nations are looking at this, and the Conventional Weapons Convention, a dreadfully named thing that they're looking at the moment, it's mainly, apparently, the United States, Israel and Russia, who are the three countries that are holding up agreements on these autonomous weapons.
Well, I must admit it's an area in which I'm still learning, as many people are.
I think the whole world is thinking the same, aren't they?
It's not surprising that they're developing autonomous weapons. I mean, from a military point of view, you can see why you'd develop them. They don't have morale problems.
That's right.
And, that's probably the sort of thing that they're considering.
Anyway, another thing that Peter Osoro looked at was the links between Google and these drone companies, these autonomous weapon companies, the killer robot firms. And this, obviously, is extremely worrying. And it's interesting to see that a whole load of Google employees have kicked off against their management about these military contracts.
The Pentagon really has trouble, I think, attracting talent. There's, a really strong demand for artificial intelligence researchers and developers right now, because there's so many applications and there's so much business opportunity around it. It actually turns out the military opportunities are not nearly as lucrative as a lot of the other business applications. Google and Amazon and Facebook and Microsoft can offer enormous salaries to people with PhDs in machine learning or even just master's degrees or some experience in systems development. And the Pentagon can't compete with that on government salaries. And I think they're even having trouble getting, certain contracts with these companies. But when they get a contract with a company like Google, then they're able to get access to really the top talent in artificial intelligence and their cloud research groups and engineering and also the sort of enormous capacity computationally of Google that has these massive data centers and processing capabilities. And then you're also getting, in some ways, Google is a company that collects data about people all over the world every day, all the time, every Google search that you do. And there's millions of Google searches per second or something in the world, right? So they have also the potential of applying data that's collected from the public in all these complicated ways. It's really a kind of a unique company in these respects. And I think as a company that collects that kind of private data, they also have a certain obligation to society to ensure that that data isn't used in detrimental ways. And siding with a single military in the world and using data that might be coming from users in countries where that military is operating, I think that's deeply problematic. And we, as academics, kind of lined up with the engineers and researchers at Google who were already protesting Google's involvement in this project. They were concerned about their involvement in the drone program. They were concerned about how this could be applied to autonomous weapon systems in the future. And they were just generally concerned with Google's attempt to become a major military contractor and not just, selling a simple service like a word processor or a search, which they do anyway, but actually developing customized systems to do military operations, analyze these systems and apply their engineering skills and resources to that. So we really joined together as academics to support those workers. The workers passed around an open letter, and then we passed around our letter. So the Google employees letter received over 4,000 signatures, and our letter from academics received almost 1,200, few shy. So we really got a lot of, I think, mobilization and awareness. And then Google agreed to not renew that contract. So they're not dropping it. They're going to continue it till the end of the year, but they've said that they will not renew it in the future.
Well, that's a podcast from the Future of Life Institute. There are just a couple of extracts from it. Peter Asaro from New York City University. Martin, this is a horrendous area of science, isn't it? We've just heard literally the most recent story on this one from a week or so ago. Elon Musk has pledged not to manufacture disgusting killer robots. There are one or two other people who've taken this pledge, but I mean, surely the military are just going to do it one way or another.
Well, I mean, there's a question of whether you should have a military at all. And if you're going to have a military at all, I suppose they're going to want killer robots. The question of whether Google, as a, you know, people-friendly company, as it tries to present itself as, should be involved in that is another question, isn't it? You know, the military is embedded in everything that we do as a result of the war on terror, the manipulations that are going on behind the scenes and all the rest of it. So the actual mechanisms by which violence is carried out are, in a sense, secondary. I mean, artificial intelligence robots are no more evil in one way than dropping bombs from a conventional aeroplane when you shouldn't be doing it.
What about the comparison there with tort law we heard at the beginning, where he's saying effectively someone that manufactures one of these, anyone that's killed by it, there should be compensation afterwards?
Yeah, well, that's basic you know, law for lawful circumstances. But war is an unlawful circumstance by definition. I mean, in a war, you kill people and you get indemnity to do so. Although, of course, some people then get called terrorists and arrested. Others get pensions at taxpayers' expense.
I see. Also, as a last word tonight, Cy Hirsch, one of your favourite journalists, has come out saying Bin Laden didn't do 9/11.
He didn't say that exactly. He said he doubts whether the story stands up, which is probably as far as somebody in his position can go. But the fact is, as you know, Tony, and we've covered on this show for many years, the story of 9/11 is basically bogus.
Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 8. Coming up live on Facebook, Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi. You'll find this show's podcast, story links, comment page, and our contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. Glastonbury Abbey on Tuesday at noon. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.